From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You break it, you own it. The famous words of former Secretary of State General Colin Powell. 2.5 years after crushing the Iraqi army, the U.S. now owns it. And it is spending a lot of time, money, and manpower trying to build a new Iraqi army from the bottom up. So how's it going? Are there more Iraqi troops trained, equipped, and inclined to establish law and order and fight the insurgency? Last week, General George Casey told Congress that only one Iraqi battalion is combat ready. That is, 750 ready Iraqi troops out of 200,000 being trained. In June, General Casey said there were 3 battalions ready. Since Casey's comment last week, the president and the generals have rushed to the airwaves to say training is on track and headed in the right direction. Here's President Bush speaking at yesterday's press conference.
There's obviously more work to be done, more units to be stood up, but we've got, as I said, 30 battalions are in the lead, and that's positive progress.
This hour on Point, what's the real story with Iraqi troop strength? When, if ever, will they carry the load so U.S. troops can come home? We begin in Washington with Mark Mazzetti, Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you make of the scramble in the past week? We had General Casey saying something pretty clear and pretty upsetting, obviously, to members of Congress and the public, that out of all these battalions where we had thought maybe 3 were ready, he was saying only 1. And then what sounds like a reversal since then, is there a clear understanding in the Pentagon of who's ready, how much readiness there is?
General Casey's comments last week certainly had a lot of senators scratching their heads. And as you pointed out, he said that there's only one Iraqi battalion that could operate totally independently of the United States. If the United States were to leave, that they could actually fight insurgents.
And that's one out of 119 Iraqi battalions, doesn't sound like a good percentage.
That's correct. And what the White House, what President Bush said yesterday, what the general said over the weekend was that there are, in fact, 30 battalions which are at the second category of readiness, which is they're in the lead. They just can't operate on their own.
What does the lead mean, Mark?
Well, in the lead means that they are launching offensives against insurgents, particularly in western Iraq, over the last couple weeks. But they need a lot of training help, they need a lot of logistical help, and they need a lot of what the U.S. military has in Iraq, like firepower, like aircraft, that type of thing, that they can operate in these missions, but they still need extensive support from the United States.
So you're the Pentagon correspondent. Help us parse what all this means. I mean, first of all, why did the number of fully ready battalions fall since midsummer, by General Casey's estimate, from 3 to 1, even before we look at the 30 in the lead? Why the decline in the full readiness quotient there?
We never got an entirely clear answer to that. He was asked several times about that. He said, well, in some cases, we raised the standard for what it really means to be Category 1.
Okay.
But then they also said, well, there may have been some key officers who left, and this created some chaos in the battalions. In other words, there was never really a very clear answer about why this happened. It was clearly a setback, not only for the image of progress, but also, really, you know, as you said, 2.5 years after the war ended, it is it's pretty tough when the top general in Iraq said there's only one battalion that's fully capable.
I mean tough. It's shocking. 750 men out of potentially 200,000. I mean, it's nothing.
And especially in the face of the fits and starts of this whole training mission. I mean, as remember, in the fall of 2003, you heard one administration official after another keep citing ever-increasing figures of trained and ready Iraqi troops. It seemed like every week there were 50,000 new troops who were ready. Finally, last year, they said, okay, that was really not a good plan. We have overhauled the system. We are now going to be training them extensively, and we're going to be grading them.
But it sounds like it was a good plan. If you had 50, 30, 40, 50,000 ready to come on, why would that's a good plan, but it wasn't real?
It wasn't real. Because what we saw in the spring of 2004 in the Fallujah offensive was that all these troops that they said were ready melted away. They were incapable of fighting. And it was that spring where the U.S. realized that their entire training mission had been sort of all for naught. And so they had to totally overhaul it.
When General Casey spoke to Congress and he says, we've only got one battalion ready now, what was he saying there? Was he trying to say, we're in trouble, we're failing, or we're succeeding very slowly? What was the import of that?
No, he was not trying to present that at all. And actually, he only said it after Senator McCain pressed him about these numbers. They say that the training is going very well, but they say that people focus too much on this Category 1. They say that the ones we should focus on are this Category 2, which is, as President Bush said yesterday, the number that can really take the lead and eventually, within a couple of years, be fully ready to operate without the United States.
But right now, that would be take the lead with heavy U.S. support.
Currently, they do need U.S. support, and even the most optimistic people at the Pentagon believe it will be years before the United States can really step off and let the Iraqis take over entirely. This is a very long proposition.
So what's the sense among Pentagon correspondents, Mark Mazzetti, as the generals came out over the weekend and seemed to backpedal or to shift their interpretation of what's going on? Were they clarifying for accuracy, or were they bending the story so that it was more politically palatable?
They were trying to take people's focus off this embarrassing fact that they've gone from 3 to 1 battalions at the highest level of readiness. And they were trying to emphasize the positive, and they were trying to say, but we have a lot more that are nearly ready. They do see that there's a lot of politics in here, and they do see that they've got to present the image of progress. I don't think they were trying to bend the story. They were just trying to emphasize a different aspect of the story.
And what about this, Mark, this sort of bigger picture? President Bush has said repeatedly, as Iraqis stand up, American forces will stand down. That's the formula for getting out of Iraq. But in recent months, we've heard again and again, look, these forces are not being really trained up to keep peace. They may be being trained up to fight one another, that Iraqi forces are themselves dividing into sectarian clusters. So is the basic formula still seen to be working here? If they're trained to go, the U.S. can leave, or are they trained to go to fight one another?
Well, I think that last week you saw a really interesting, subtle shift in the message from the generals. And it was really a divergence from what President Bush has articulated, as you just articulated, that as they stand up, we'll stand down. What the generals were saying last week was that the U.S. increasingly is part of the problem in Iraq, that the U.S. troops are not only helping fuel the insurgency, but they're also creating this dependency among Iraqi troops on them. Mm-hmm. So sort of the generals had a twist in that formulation. They were sort of saying, it's not until we stand down can they stand up. And, oh, by the way, you know, the 150,000 U.S. troops in Iraq might be part of the problem in that they're helping fuel sectarian violence, they're helping fuel, the insurgents and also Islamic fundamentalism across the Middle East. So it was very interesting. The body language and the actual language from the generals was, we need to start drawing down in Iraq.
We're trying to read exactly what they're saying, and you're giving us a good hand here. Mark Mazzetti with the LA Times Pentagon correspondent, we appreciate your being with us today. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure, thanks.
I want to turn now to Monterey, California. We're joined from Monterey by retired Lieutenant Colonel Caliph Sepp. He teaches defense studies at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. He was recently part of a team sent to Iraq by General George Casey to assess counterinsurgency tactics. Lieutenant Colonel Sepp, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
And with us from Washington, Wayne White, adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute, former deputy director of the State Department's Middle East Intelligence Office. He was head of State Department Iraq Intelligence from 2003 to March of this year. Been following Iraq for the past 26 years. Wayne White, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Great to be on your show.
Colonel Sepp, first to you. We heard this number from General Casey last week. It was a stunner. It turned a lot of congressional heads and public heads. It made it seem as though we've got a fiasco on our hands in troop training in Iraq. Is it that bad or something better?
It's certainly not a fiasco, and it's wrong to cast it that way. This is
good.
This is part of a very difficult, very long-term process to create from nothing Iraqi security forces. We had completely wiped them away, in particular by the disestablishment of the Iraqi army, and we were at zero. And so this is a two-sided process. One is to rebuild the Iraqi army, and the other is simultaneously we needed to create a training system that didn't exist within our own force structure training system for that Iraqi force.
So we know it's been a huge challenge, but here we are 2.5 years out, and we have one fully ready battalion out of 119, General Casey said last week. Is that success, or does that indicate we're on the path to success? It doesn't sound good.
Well, one thing that's very credible is that General Casey has the integrity and the wherewithal to report honestly.
We love that, and we salute that straight up.
But the fact is that just creating battalions by themselves is not going to be the whole solution. The larger structure of the Army, the infrastructure, the logistics, the national command and control structures that enable us to say that a given Iraqi unit can operate independently rests on all of these other elements falling into place as well, and that's still in development.
A lot of work to do here. We're going to dig into all of it this hour. Wayne White, your sense of how this is going. We'll stand down as they stand up, says President Bush. You've just got half a minute before the break, but is this training process, is this refurbishment of the Iraqi Army, reestablishment, as Caliph Sepp says, is it happening? Is it working?
Well, I think some of the factors that we have to consider are not just training. It's whether units have the will to fight for this government, which at the present time is perceived as rather shaky. And it's also something you've touched upon, the ethno-sectarian makeup of the units. If, as many of them are, lopsidedly Shia and Kurd, you actually can exacerbate problems by employing them.
Ethno-sectarian makeup. We're going to have to look at that as well. Wayne White, Caliph Sepp, please stand by. We're talking this hour about Iraqi force preparedness. Listeners, you can join us. If the key to getting U.S. troops out of Iraq is to rebuild the Iraqi army, how are we doing in that effort? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Iraqi force preparedness and the future of the conflict in Iraq. You can join the conversation. Do you see real progress, or is the stone rolling back down the hill? And why is it so hard to get a clear picture from the Pentagon and the White House? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined in this hour by retired Lieutenant Colonel Caliph Sepp. He is retired Special Forces Lieutenant Colonel, now Professor of Defense Studies at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. From Washington by Wayne White. He was head of the State Department's Iraq Intelligence Unit from 2003 to March of this year. And now also from Washington by Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow of Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution, author of Defense Strategy for the Post-Saddam Era, visiting lecturer at Princeton University. Michael O'Hanlon, thank you for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
What do you make of the one step forward and two steps back, or I don't know what you call it, the dust-up, the statement and retraction that we've seen essentially in the past week from the Pentagon and White House about Iraqi force preparedness? Is it going well or going poorly?
Well, I think they made a fairly straightforward issue more complicated than it had to be. Here's how I would summarize three main points. One, the overall trend of how Iraq is going is, of course, a very complex situation. And there your one step forward, two steps back may sometimes be, unfortunately, the right way to think about it. It really is hard to work out analytically whether the overall trend in Iraq is positive or negative. But that's a broader question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Secondly, on the issue of Iraqi training, after squandering the first year, and I don't think we did a very good job in that initial period, I think we have been quite robust and rigorous ever since basically Dave Petraeus, the Army General, took over in June 2004 at about the time we were transferring sovereignty to Iraqis. And I think since that time, we've had a very good training program. And I think if you focus on the number of Iraqi units that are at least at the second level of proficiency, the overall trend is slow, but definitely in the right direction.
Okay.
And it would be surprising if it weren't. We have, again, very good training. We're teaching technical skills, which to some extent can be quantified, measured in an objective way. And I do think that if you focus on that second level of excellence, where they can do most of the operations on their own, we definitely see a trend in the right direction.
And this is the 30 battalion. This is the 30 battalions President Bush was referring to yesterday, out of 119.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And that's the more important category, I think, than the number that are in that very top tier, where they can do everything on their their own. Third point, however, and this throws a little bit of cold water on what I just said, no one, of course, knows whether these units are going to hold together politically, the degree of their political allegiance to the unified Iraqi state, the degree to which they will not fracture into different ethnic pieces if and when the United States leaves and then leaves the Iraqi forces to handle things largely on their own. And given the problems we're having with the Constitution and everything else, there is a real danger of inter-ethnic strife tearing this military apart. But I think that the technical proficiency of the units and their equipment capabilities are definitely headed in the right direction. And I think the administration really should have been able to make that point a lot more clearly, because it is a fairly simple and I think fairly unobjectionable and straightforward point.
The right direction, but in an environment of flux, or the phrase we've heard recently, super flux. So we're beginning to get the pieces on the table here, and a lot of listeners want to join us. Let me turn to them. Nicholas is calling from Rochester. Hi, Nicholas. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Good show as always.
Thanks, Nicholas. What do you think?
My question is, I continue to hear people talking about these battalions being ready, being equipped, etc. This level one, does that mean these guys can go out there and fight without our artillery, without our air support, without our armor? I don't think so.
Nicholas, what's your own? Do you have a military background?
I'm a retired Marine.
And you're skeptical from the bleachers here?
Absolutely.
Well, let us turn to Colonel Sepp. Colonel Sepp, what can you tell us about the way the training has evolved since the first, I think, pretty clearly unsuccessful efforts, and the actual readiness? You're speaking to a retired Marine who wants to know, can they really and truly do it all, or how close are they getting?
The focus right now is not on a large combined arms army on the American model that has artillery and tanks in it. The focus is very much on light infantry skills, which are what is necessary to fight these insurgents.
Okay. And you're saying have they gained adequate competency at this 30 battalion level? I guess that's category 2 is the new terminology we're learning, that they can do how much with that? The President Bush calls them lead battalions. Does that mean that they really and truly take the lead? And how dependent are they on U.S. support?
Dr. O'Hanlon described this in excellent fashion. In each of those units, there's still elements of U.S. support that's required, whether it's in staff support for logistics, leadership assistance, planning in the operations staff, sometimes material support in terms of what the caller mentioned, sometimes heavier fire support that's required in certain situations. But they're developing to correct those and fill in for those deficiencies that they have now.
And Colonel Sepp, what about this issue of the willingness to fight and to hang in when fighting actually begins? We saw Iraqi units essentially evaporate in some earlier conflicts. How has the training tried to address that? How do you train men, I guess, in the case of Iraq, so that they don't go away when the fighting begins?
That has two sides to the answer. One of them, the key in particularly, as Dr. O'Hanlon was mentioning, that General Petraeus emphasized, was development of leadership in those units, and leadership will help hold them together. But Wayne White really hit on it when he talked about what is their motivation. And until a viable government that really represents Iraq emerges, and concurrently a functioning economy can be created, that motivation is going to be hard to draw out of the troops.
You're speaking as an ex-military man retired who's advised General Casey. I mean, asking for a viable government and economy seems like an awfully tall order. We've sort of been led to think that the military would secure things in order to make those possible. Have we got the order reversed here? Is it possible to create an effective Iraqi military force without those precursors, Colonel Sepp?
It's not sequential. It needs to be a simultaneous effort. Historical analyses of insurgencies and counterinsurgencies over the past century show that when somebody takes up the false strategy of a sequential step, that either you need security before you can create a government and establish an economy, the counterinsurgencies fail. The effective ones integrate these simultaneously, and that can be done. It certainly needs to be done in the American effort in Iraq.
So you've got to do it all at once. Wayne White, there's a pretty big kind of provision laid down by Colonel Sepp. This all has to happen together. Michael O'Hanlon says it's hard to gauge how things are going overall. You're saying look to motivation. Do you see that motivation piece coming into clearer focus, getting more focused on goals that would be shared by Washington?
No, I don't, and I think Califf has it right that this has to be not sequential, but it has to move forward and also has to gain momentum on a variety of fronts. And so far, we haven't built up that kind of momentum. But you know, there's a clock ticking here, aside from our own decisions to withdraw and how and when, and that is that the more Iraqi units don't stand up and do melt away, or the Sunni Arabs leave the units when they're pushed into combat, the more pressure builds up for the use of ethno-sectarian militias in lieu of the army.
And we've seen this already. We've seen them deployed.
We've seen it in Tel Afar just recently with Kurds. Mm-hmm. Embedded correspondents have told me that in Operation Matador, we used a Shiite Badr Corps militia from the south, from Basra specifically. And this is exactly what you do not want to do, because this lays a siege for civil war.
Michael O'Hanlon, what about that ticking clock? Is the U.S. military already reaching out to what Wayne White describes provocatively as ethno-sectarian military units in Iraq, militias, and kind of doing an end run on the formal Iraqi army? Does that set up the mold for division, failure, central collapse?
Well, it's a very risky strategy, no doubt. I'm not sure there's any strategy that's less risky that's available to us, unfortunately. But I certainly share the concern, and I think there are a lot of clocks ticking, or a lot of reasons why there is time pressure here. And, of course, we have the constitutional referendum, which I'm worried now is going to be, despite all the very impressive work of many people, especially Iraqis, but also Ambassador Khalilzad and many in the Bush administration, despite all the impressive work, it may wind up being more of a divisive document than a unifying document. And that's one more thing that's going to potentially pull this apart. So I, unfortunately, while I do see a lot of positive things happening in Iraq, I think we're very much in danger of having this go still the wrong way. I don't think it's the likely outcome, but it's very plausible that we could wind up seeing an escalating insurgency or even civil conflict.
Lou is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Lou, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. You guys bring up these discussions quite a bit about Iraq, and my question is, whatever happened to the Republican Guard, Saddam Hussein's elite? I mean, these guys were so intense that Saddam did not want them within the boundaries of Baghdad. So if they ever attempted a coup, he would be able to have some time to react.
So why not just blow the whistle and muster them out again? We've got that, Lou, and let us look at it. Colonel Sepp, what about the Republican Guard? There was one time a kind of fierce mythology around them, as Lou says. They were disbanded along with the rest of the army. Is there an Iraqi fighting force just waiting to be called back? Is it now facing U.S. troops in opposition? Has it been subsumed into the insurgency? Where did they go?
Tom, you know, you used a terrific word just then. It is a mythology about the Republican Guard, and also that list of what has happened to the members of the now disbanded Saddam army is absolutely correct. Mark Mazzetti of the L.A. Times, as a matter of fact, who you talked to previously,
yes,
has done some excellent writing on this. The mythology is that the Republican Guard was this sort of Waffen-SS like unit, you know, superbly trained, and that they're still resident someplace. By the time of the American invasion, this was simply not true. It was they were very much a house of cards, very much a front organization, but politically very close to Hussein, and a number of the officers and special troops did have the kind of training that we now see emerging among the insurgent organizations, and that's certainly where a number of them are.
But yeah, someone is keeping a superpower pretty tied up in knots there in Iraq, Michael O'Hanlon. Do you see Do you see the fingerprints of the former Iraqi army in the insurgency?
I wouldn't be surprised, although what they're doing now involves a somewhat different set of skills and tactics than what they were traditionally trained to do, and what they tried to do when they fought the Iranians, for example, in the 1980s. And when they fought Iraq's own civilian populations, of course, they used some of the most brutal sledgehammer-like tactics imaginable that did not require much sophistication. But unfortunately, they do seem, or at least some of them, seem fairly adaptable. I might say, in addition, that, you know, we sort of tried the caller's idea, in a sense, in Fallujah in 2004, if you recall. After the failed raid in April of 2004, we decided to essentially resuscitate the rank and the position of some former Baathists who then were going to try to keep the reins on at least Fallujah for us. And then, of course, Fallujah became more and more a sanctuary for al-Qaeda. So right. I'm afraid the real concern here is, in addition to the possibility that if you build yet another set of ethnic militias, you could worsen the risk of civil war. Also, some of these Baathists actually are the very folks, as you're implying yourself, Tom, behind the insurgency, and we're essentially going to be giving them more power and authority. And we already tried it once in Fallujah, and it didn't work. So while I hear the idea, and we do want to tap into the individual expertise of certain people, I don't think we want to resuscitate the units as such.
Talk about a challenge. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Stephen is calling from Boston. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Good to have you.
I guess I should start off by saying that I'm a captain in the Army Reserve. In February, I completed a year tour as an advisor to the new Iraqi Army. I arrived in April of 2004, probably the week after the security infrastructure imploded in Iraq.
And just before General Petraeus came in to do things. What did you see? Give us your report, Stephen.
Well, yes, I arrived and General Eaton was still in charge there. Mm-hmm. And I'd just like to say that, you know, when this whole effort began, as early as 2003, General Eaton was pretty upfront and he said, look, you know, I'm being tasked to form 27 battalions in like 6 months. And if we were to do that with our own army, it could take up to a decade. So, you know, I think there should have been no illusion that this would be something we could do overnight. As far as some of what the callers are saying about using the former Iraqi military, they are there. They're present in the ranks of the new Iraqi military, and in some cases holding very high rank. But their level of proficiency, their level of tactical and technical proficiency, their ability to perform staff functions are nowhere near on par with their Western counterparts.
So what do you think, Stephen, when the president says, as they stand up, we'll stand down, you've been there in the Army Reserve helping train them, is that formula going to work?
Ultimately, yes, but it's going to take a lot of time, and it's going to require a lot of patience on behalf of the American public.
What do you mean by a lot of time, Captain?
I'm certainly not an expert, but I can tell you that with the units that I worked with the men that I worked with, I think they really need some more material resource, and they're going to need a lot more training, up into including coming to the West for some of our service schools, kind of being immersed in a professional environment. That's really one of the biggest problems with the old Army, is it was not a true professional Army at all.
So when General Casey talks about how they've only got one that's fully ready now, do you think he's bad-mouthing the effort, or he's a truth-teller?
I don't think he's bad-mouthing the effort at all. In fact, I'm very happy to hear him say that, because it's finally sort of the honesty that all of us advisors have been looking forward to hearing. I have to say, too, is that Iraq is a pretty complicated place, and there's absolutely no way you can describe anything in a 30-second soundbite. So when I say that this is going to require patience on behalf of the American people, that's a very accurate statement. And I don't know, I guess I'd like to see more media coverage of some of the Iraqi soldiers we've been working with. We have a lot of success stories out there, a lot of ethnic integration that is working very successfully. The unit that I was in, which is called the Iraqi Intervention Force, it was created in the wake of the April 2004 security
yes.
implosion,
mm-hmm.
is very ethnically diverse. We have Kurdish leaders, Arabic leaders, both Sunni and Shia. And while occasionally you'll see something flare up, particularly on a tribal level, for the most part, you know, a lot of times coming from me, and frankly I was pretty well respected by my Iraqi counterpart,
yeah.
a lot of times it just sort of took that look you give your kids when you're sort of disappointed in them.
And they were back in line. Stephen, we've got to take a break, but we're so grateful for your report from the front line. Hopeful, but it's going to take a long, long time, says this Army Reserve captain. Colonel Caliph Sepp, Wayne White, Michael O'Hanlon, please stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking about Iraqi force preparedness and the future of the conflict in Iraq. Listeners, you can join us. 1-800-423-8255. Captain Stephen, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Iraqi force preparedness and the future of the conflict in Iraq. We're joined in this hour from Washington by Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow on Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution, by Wayne White, also in Washington, Adjunct Scholar at the Middle East Institute. He was head of the State Department's Iraq Intelligence Unit from 2003 to March of this year, and from Monterey, California, by retired Special Forces Lieutenant Colonel Caliph Sepp, teaches defense studies at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Joe is calling from Scituate, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Thank you. Yes, one of my grave concerns as a Republican who originally supported the effort and now has doubts is that Saddam is still alive, and I'll make it that clear and concise. If I were from Iraq and grew up with generations of the oppression where any member of my family could be dragged out of my home any second of the day, and I see that he survived time and time again, failed coups, he survived the 91 Gulf War to oppress his people further, I simply would not believe that the United States was going to stay, especially in light of our pullout in Somalia and some other what I feel are political mistakes. What we need to do is set a deadline, and there's a political issue. Bush, if he supports the troops, to say Saddam must finish his justice in 3 months, that's it. They're all afraid to do it. In fact, I don't even believe that they're an Iraqi justice system apparatus ready to convict him. I think they're all waiting and seeing because they're waiting to see if he comes back.
So we've got the trial upcoming, but you're saying as long as he's there, there's a shadow and there's a shudder. Joe, we've got it. You raise a lot of issues there. Let me put it to our guest, Wayne White, first to you. Just on this issue of the signals that Iraqis are getting about the future and how that may affect their willingness to line up with this or that agenda. Joe points to Saddam still alive and says that may scare people away or keep them fearful. You've been the head of intelligence for the State Department there. What do you think is creating the surround, the kind of atmosphere in which Iraqis are making decisions about where to put their shoulder?
I think you have to go into different directions to find the atmosphere here and there. Obviously, the most important atmospheric is the lack of simple normalcy and stability throughout the country, which is keeping all communities on edge, with the possible exception of Kurds, but more importantly, drawing the Sunni Arabs into the mainstream, which is, of course, the main political effort. But the issue of Saddam is interesting because I think everyone's gone back and forth about what to do with him. And there are some actually who feel that if you do away with Saddam, you'll actually infuriate and re-energize a lot of the Sunni Arab former regime elements in the insurgency. One thing that often goes neglected, let me get it in here, is that Saddam's number two, Izzedi Ibrahim ad-Douri, is still at large. So even if you do away with Saddam, there is a large secondary symbolic political official at large and doubtlessly involved in the insurgency.
Widely rumored or even assumed to be at work there. But what about, let's just go right at Joe's point. Joe says as long as Saddam is alive, even if he's in a prison somewhere under American custody, Iraqis may fear that the U.S. will pull out and that he'll come back. Did you, in your intelligence work, do you see that as a real fear among Iraqis?
Personally, I did not see that exact issue. But there are Shia, for sure, and Kurds who suffered because of him who will feel that way. But I don't think that's central to this process.
Michael O'Hanlon, your sense of motivators here. I mean, among the things that General Casey said last week to Congress was that the large American military presence in Iraq itself, quoting him, feeds the notion of occupation and, quoting him again, extends the amount of time that it will take for Iraqi security forces to become self-reliant. The caller asks about Saddam, but what about the United States itself? There's this push within the U.S. military to draw down forces to create, I guess, a greater sense of Iraqi self-reliance or responsibility for their own future, or at least less antagonism from the notion of an occupier. How big a factor is that?
Well, I agree with General Casey, although I don't think it's the main problem in Iraq now, and nor do I think that Saddam being still alive is the main problem. I think the main problem really is that life is extraordinarily uncertain, crime-ridden and violent for many Iraqi citizens in large sectors of the country, and there really has not been measurable progress in their quality of life since Saddam was overthrown. That feeds frustration and bitterness. And now on top of that, the Iraqi political process, which has had so many impressive accomplishments in the short period of about 16 months, that it's been fully underway since sovereignty was transferred, has nonetheless not succeeded in bringing the Sunni Arabs aboard in any kind of a systematic way. And in fact, it risks now further alienating them. I think those are the central problems. The U.S. presence, I think, is indeed a problem. And my colleague here, Jim Steinberg, and I have been arguing for a year and a half that we should have a schedule to reduce our forces, not to withdraw them entirely, but to reduce them and try to hold to that schedule and announce it publicly for the very reason you're mentioning and that General Casey was getting at. But I would not go so far as to say that's the main problem. The main problem in Iraq today is, A, life is very unsettled and the place is quite violent. And secondly, the sectarian issue have not been worked out.
And it sounds like an endless chicken and egg problem that William is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. William, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. We talked about a few things here, particularly the Kurds, the Sunnis, and the Shias, mm-hmm. and the interplay there.
Yes.
I wonder, what sort of mix do we have within the battalions of those ethnic groups?
You mean, are the battalions themselves...
Is there any sort of standard? Do they have Kurdish battalions, Sunni battalions, Shia battalions, or are they just mixed battalions?
Let us pick it up. Colonel Sepp, are there ethno-sectarian battalions as such? Are they mixed battalions? What's the answer?
The answer to the caller's question is yes, 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 and yes. Depending on the province, the district, the town... the units that have been raised, and when talk about Iraqi security forces, this includes the police, are in some cases pure. Best examples of that are you can find in the Kurdish regions. Other units are deliberately very mixed, but others fall into different proportions.
What's working best? What formula seems to work best? I hate to use the word, but pure or unmixed units or mixed units?
It depends on the locality. This isn't you can't think of the insurgency or the counterinsurgency effort in Iraq as a single effort where there is a set model that will apply everywhere. It's 100 little wars, and they have to be focused on what works best in that locality.
Overall, are Sunnis fully represented in the Iraqi military that you're attempting to revive, or are Shia more heavily represented than they are in the general population?
No, the Sunnis aren't as well represented because they're the basis of the resistance, and they resist on two levels. One is the active level. We can estimate that about 90% of the active combatant insurgents are Sunnis. And then they resist on the passive level, the sense that they're not going to engage in the new government. Fortunately, the political process that Michael O'Hanlon was describing is going forward. And one of the key lessons that came out of the January elections to the Sunnis was that they're going to be left behind if they don't engage in that political process. And when that happens, then their representation in security forces should improve.
But is that, I mean, at this point, the Sunnis may be taking the lesson that they're simply not going to be find a home in that process. The referendum mechanism on the Constitution itself has been changed, so they really can't reject it at this point. Wayne White, is it possible that we've already gone past some kind of tipping point, that the Sunni are not going to come into this formula willingly?
It is a definite possibility, Tom, one that worries me very greatly. In fact, one thing that I'm worried about is that it has been so hard to bring the Sunnis meaningfully into the political process, into the mainstream, that we may actually see the Kurds and the Shia giving up on trying and basically going ahead in effect in their separate way in order to ensure security in their own areas. The Constitution, which was supposed to be unifying, as has been mentioned, has had the opposite effect. And also, this Constitution has a very, very weak central government. And I think that was made just so in such a situation Shia and Kurd could take care of themselves in a situation where the Sunnis remained out.
Mm. Michael O'Hanlon, let me ask you, we had planned this hour to be talking with the correspondent Robert Kaplan. He's got his new book out, Imperial Grunts. He's writing about the soldier's eye view of what's going on in the world. He got trapped in fog on the Washington runway, and we're delighted to have each of you with us. But what's your sense, and I'll ask Colonel Sepp as well, but your sense of how the U.S. military is looking at this whole challenge at this point? Americans seem to be confused often about whether things are going well or poorly. Was the country hoodwinked, or how deeply? Is the military feeling like it got pulled into something here, you know, a briar patch not as described? Do they still have the same kind of agenda as the political side of our government, as the White House?
Well, it's a very interesting question. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were asking
Michael O'Hanlon, please. Yes.
But I'll be glad to hear the colonel's comments too, because they'll be, of course, more.
And we will go there. Yes.
But my reaction is that in the course of 2005, we've seen a very interesting split get much greater between how many military officers, at least the ones I've spoken with, feel about how Iraq is going and how most of the rest of the country seems to feel. The military is more optimistic on balance, from what I can tell, than many civilian analysts or the public at large. On top of that, and here I think the colonel will have a better ability to comment, but I'll throw a hypothesis on the table. I think the military, even those who are skeptical about how things are going, even those who acknowledge that Saddam was not an imminent threat the way we talked about in 2002, mm-hmm. even those who may not be supporters of President Bush, still believe that the effort is a legitimate one, because we did, in fact, overthrow one of the worst tyrants of the late 20th century, and we are at least giving the Iraqi people a chance at a better future, even if it's by no means preordained that we will be successful. Mm. And so I think there's, of course, a can-do attitude among the military, and plus a sense of investment that as a nation we've invested, but they've really invested in the lives of their compatriots under arms. And so I find very few military personnel who are strongly opposed to this war. There are a number who are nervous about it, or who would acknowledge that it was what Richard Haass, a former Bush official, called mm-hmm. a war of choice. Mm-hmm. We didn't have to fight it right then. But I think almost everyone I talked to says it was legitimate. The goals are noble. The purpose is defensible and right. And we are at least giving the Iraqis a chance. And moreover, most of them think that things are going better. Maybe that's partly a reflection of their can-do attitude, but things are going better than, in fact, many of us back here at home believe. I don't necessarily think the military is correct in its optimism, but I admire their tenacity, their conviction, and I think they're right to say that this war is a noble effort. Whether you think it was a mistake or not, I think it was motivated by noble goals and can still do net good, but we just don't know for sure just yet.
Colonel Sepp, take us into that. We trust in the can-do outlook of the U.S. military, and yet, as General Casey testified last week, we felt a kind of tension in the air, maybe a little more truth-telling than the political side of our government was prepared for. Does the U.S. military itself feel it was misled into this war? And does that affect its view of how the war ought to be pursued at this point?
Tom, I have to say that I think that what Michael O'Hanlon just said is just precisely correct. The view that I saw, and this was my third tour of duty in Iraq, mm-hmm. Working on these senior staffs and on the team that I was on, that General Casey sent around the country to survey the troops, I saw exactly what Michael was describing. But down at that level of the sergeants and lieutenants and captains,
yes,
that absolutely believed that this was doable, and they're pursuing that with what can only be described as a dogged determination. I was looking for those hairline cracks in morale and if there was any disconcertedness. But the attitude is that yes, mistakes were made. There are people that in private acknowledge that their personal opinion is that the war was
may have been fought for the, you know, have been, may have been started for the wrong reasons. But the overall attitude is the time for that kind of hand-wringing and introspection is past. We are where we are, and we need to proceed, and there's a chance that we can actually make this happen.
But let me just ask you on that front. I mean, we're hearing page one, Wall Street Journal today, talking about top brass saying troops, like we just heard from General Casey's quote, that U.S. troops may be in themselves fueling the insurgency. So does doing it, does getting it done in the military view at this point mean in part getting out, Colonel Sepp?
That's the paradox that exists, absolutely. But if you look at the strategic situation in Iraq, in 14 of the 18 provinces, the conditions are fairly close to stable. It's the three Sunni provinces in Baghdad where there's the highest levels of violence.
And yet, right across the country, I mean, not in every corner, but in an awful lot of corners, people are feeling miserable. We've heard that from all of our guests this morning.
Well, this is correct, and that's the idea of what constitutes stability. And it's not just the idea of security, that there would be, you know, armed policemen on every corner. And the idea of civic peace, the way that we in America understand civic peace, it's those other components. It's the belief in a functioning government, the comfort of having a job, that comes from a functioning economy that needs to be done. Those are the components of the effort that need to be paid more attention to by the U.S. government.
And the two widely missing elements, Wayne White. We hear this can-do spirit in the U.S. military as they try and train up Iraqi forces. That is something we don't want to mess with. We don't want to break that. But do we have our military focused on a task here that is ultimately undoable, that's going to challenge that spirit itself?
Well, I think one thing that we haven't discussed, and I really agree with what I've heard from Michael and Colonel Sepp, there is this can-do attitude, but on the other hand, as we see in the Upper Euphrates and various operations there, there may still be that problem of not having enough people to do the job. Going in, hitting places, probably having as many as half or two-thirds of the insurgents scurry out the other end and get away, and then leaving and they come back. This kind of a cycle is not the way to win this war. And in trying to, address that issue of occupation, which I think is important, it is damned if you do, damned if you don't. We are a problem even in the Shia areas of the country, as we saw with the outbreak of violence between the Brits and the Shia in Basra. But if you withdraw, the Iraqis are not ready to take over right now. And they may not be ready for quite some time. But if you don't, you have the continuing problem of occupation, humiliation, etc.
Well, a challenge so big it's hard to get our arms around, but you've given us a lot of new handholds on it, and I'm grateful to each of you. Wayne White at the Middle East Institute, former head of the State Department's Iraq intelligence effort, thank you very much for being with us this hour. And Michael O'Hanlon at the Brookings Institution, author of Defense Strategy for the Post-Saddam Era, thank you, Mr. O'Hanlon, for joining us.
My pleasure.
Retired Lieutenant Colonel Caliph Sepp in Monterey, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.